Hello and welcome to End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
Vince Masson.
And thanks, guys, for joining me today. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here in our temporary home for the summer, Thursday at 10 a.m., to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the superhero action-adventure Spider-Man Homecoming. That, however, will be in the back half of the show. For this first half, considering that we have a Spider-Man movie to talk about, we thought it might be fun to recount some of our favorite comic book movies. And I think almost at this point, it's kind of a genre in its own right, especially when you're coming off this year, when you're looking at something like Logan, which is basically a Western. You're looking at a space opera in the form of Guardians of the Galaxy. You have the Spider-Man movie, which we'll talk about later, which is basically, you know, it's a high school movie, like a John Hughes movie in Spider-Man clothing. So we've all prepared kind of a top three. And hopefully we'll squeeze in good discussion about all nine. If, you know, that's mostly could go out to nine. Peter, you won the coin toss I just did in my head. So why don't you start us off with your one of your picks?
One of my picks would be Spider-Man. But the Spider-Man, done by one of my favorite directors, Sam Raimi. The first two. The third one didn't exist. And I don't know. I just, maybe it's because it was one of the first films I saw as a kid, or if it's the Tobey Maguire, who I'm a huge fan of. I just thought they were fantastic. The visuals, like looking back, the CGI is still great. And just all the characters. Kirsten Dunst is fantastic. James Franco. It's funny seeing James Franco in it. and it was just great.
Yeah, that was Franco, like, coming right off Freaks and Geeks.
I know. He was very mad that he wasn't Spider-Man, though. And you can sort of see that in his character the whole time.
Yeah, I wonder if he used that when it came to Spider-Man 3 and the events therein. It's just like, I want you to call all that, like, anger and, like, disappointment you felt in, like, not getting cast as Spider-Man and directed at Spider-Man.
I think he must have.
I remember the Sam Raimi one being, like, the first instance of, or the first, like, sort of origin kind of story as well that I saw. That one came out in, like, 2002, early 2000s, but yep. That was a pretty straightforward, he gets bitten by the spider, and then all of that stuff kind of develops. Mm-hmm. It was just tonally and I think structurally different than Spider-Man Homecoming, which was a good thing, actually. But
yeah,
we'll get into it. But,
but then they redid it all over again with Amazing
right.
Spider-Man. And it's,
yeah.
Those didn't exist.
I'm pretty sure they did exist. but Vince, why don't you give us one of yours?
Okay. So before I start with number three, I'll actually just say this. I told my girlfriend my list, and she was like, that's not a comic to some of them. So some of them are graphic novels. So I apologize if you're like, you know, I don't know what the word is, loyalist perhaps to the two different art forms. I am aware that they're different, but for the sake of this segment, I think we've decided to combine them.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
With that being said, my number three is actually a comic. And I changed it this morning, actually. It was originally something else, and then I changed it on a whim. So my number three is officially a movie called Punisher Warzone, done by a fantastic female director, Lexi Alexander, Oscar-nominated, actually. The movie is not, like, a good movie. Let me just put that out there. The movie is very, like, it belongs in the same category as The Mummy that we were talking about a few weeks ago. It's just one of those mindless, fun, entertaining movies that you can kind of watch and appreciate, not so much for the artistic value of it, but just for its entertainment value.
Right.
Very underrated comic book movie, I would say. And you could probably find it for dirt cheap now.
I do wonder, it might be an interesting debate. You know, a lot of people write off the Dolph Lundgren Punisher, obviously. from 89. Understandably so, you know, considering when you're introduced to the Punisher, you know, naked and sweaty doing like Tai Chi or something, if I remember that movie correctly. It's not, he doesn't wear a skull shirt in it either.
I never saw the Dolph Lundgren one. So how does that compare to the other Punisher?
It does. It's like a, it's, you know, it's like a cheap, crappy canon movie called The Punisher.
So it's not like an origin story either, like the Thomas Jane one kind of was?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it's touched upon or it's like a flashback thing. But like the Thomas Jane one, I like because of, I think of because of Thomas Jane, and it does a great deal of humanizing the Punisher. But for like a straight up old fashioned comic book Punisher movie, I think Punisher Warzone is the one to beat. It is brutal.
Right.
Ray Stevenson looks like he just walked off the comic book page. Yeah, it's really hardcore. I am kind of disappointed because A, you get Dominic West playing Jigsaw, playing the Joker, and I didn't feel that was like a really fleshed out character. And then second, it's really obvious it's Vancouver subbing for New York City. It's like Friday the 13th Part 8 when Vancouver is subbing for New York City there too. Except
right.
Vancouver was a fraction of the size in 1989. For mine, and I'm with you about the whole graphic novel comic book nomenclature debate. Mm-hmm. I understand that, but you know, I think it is kind of implied if it's something that's like from a sequential art format. We're including this.
Oh, okay.
I think if we were like being really hoity in terms of how we're describing this, we'd be
right.
Like, well, it's actually a list of movies that are based on sequential art. Mm-hmm. But so I chose Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, good call.
Yeah, and that that kind of follows up on, we talked about Edgar Wright last week, the Baby Driver movie, and
another Toronto filmed movie.
Mm-hmm.
Except
Canadian
it's Toronto.
Actors.
Yeah, it's Toronto playing Toronto.
Yeah,
even though it's a fake winter, which is kind of obvious because people. Even you're in a real Toronto winter and there's like a foot of snow on the ground, people don't dress how they dress in this winter, because it was actually in the dead of summer when they shot it. But yeah, it's has such a great cast. You know, you have Brie Larson, you have Mary Elizabeth Winstead, you have Alison Pill, Brandon Routh, Chris Evans, Anna Kendrick, Aubrey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
It's really Jason Schwartzman. It's a really, really great cast. Michael Cera, I'm not entirely convinced he was well cast as Scott Pilgrim. I mean, but he was kind of the flavor of the month then. I think he was arguably better as Robin in the Batman Lego movie.
Oh, he was fantastic.
But yeah, it's just, it's so much fun. It's talk about bending genres. It's got like video game influences. It's like a Cameron Crowe movie with all like the indie music stuff, and it's like a John Hughes comedy. It's an action adventure. It's so great. And if you watch like one scene alone from that movie, the scene where they're at the first battle of the bands, from beginning to end of that entire sequence, it is a laugh a minute. It is hilarious. Everybody's so on their game there, and it's such a great scene. And you stop and watch it. At least I do every time I watch that movie. That just, if you pay attention to one scene, that's the scene, because everything just clicks in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is really funny. It's got moments of actually in touch, where it's a bit touching too. Some really interesting drama, some really interesting pathos, and yeah. And then on top of it all, it's Toronto playing Toronto. Nothing else, you know. A lot of time in the annex. Especially that Honest Ed's corner, which now it's kind of a time capsule too, because Honest Ed's will soon be gone, and
I think it's already gone. They just have
they're demolishing it, in the process of demolishing it. So,
who directed Scott Pilgrim?
Yeah,
Edgar Wright.
Was
really?
It?
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
I thought you were just throwing like his name out there just because it was in the style of.
Well, it's in the Edgar Wright style, but it's an Edgar
it's
Wright
also
movie.
His.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Okay,
that explains why he's able to get that cast too, like people like Jason Schwartzman and higher up people.
Yeah, it's such a great cast, and everybody's so great in it, and I think. Even though I think everybody has kind of like, with the exception of Winstead and Sarah, everybody, almost everybody's in like the one scene, but speaking of one scene, so Chris Evans, who's now very well known for being Captain America, he's so hilarious as one of the evil exes, where it's just like this former skater turn. How's it described in the movie? He used to be a pretty good skater. Now he's a pretty good actor. So he's especially good in it. And Brendan Routh, too, of course. It's someone else who's known for being a superhero in Superman Returns. And now he's on TV as the Atom on Legends of Tomorrow. So, you know, it's great. And I can't speak highly enough. And it disappoints me to this day greatly that it bombed. I don't understand how a movie this good bombs. But
it's become a cult classic.
Well, I mean, we can debate about, is it better to be loved by a few for the long term or loved by some or loved by many in the immediate? It's, anyway. Peter, second choice.
My second choice. There were so many to pick from. And I was thinking of picking Spider-Man 2 just because I love it. But I think I'm going to go with X-Men 2. Bryan Singer is another one of my favorite directors. Just director, not person. And X-2 I find the best of the three by far. Partly because Rogue, Anna Paquin, she doesn't have her own storyline in that one, where she does in the first one and the third one. And just Hugh Jackman is the Wolverine. Again, I saw this as a kid in theaters, so that might be a reason I love it. It was just great. All the actors, except for Cyclops. I forget his name. But
James Marsden.
Yeah, James Marsden. I'm glad he's not really in film so much anymore.
Oh.
Are you a fan?
I'm not a fan of his, but he tries hard. And he wasn't bad in Superman Returns, actually, which is what, you know, why he kind of wasn't back per se for, I think he kind of gets shafted. I think not just Marsden, but I think the Cyclops character period gets shafted.
He's not in it much at all. Like in the comic books, he's the main character, and all of the Bryan Singer ones, he's just kind of in the background.
Yeah, and that's a shame. I mean, one of the things I will say about X2, and there's a debate in my head about what's better, X2 or Days of Future Past.
Days of Future Past is pretty great.
Yeah, but X2 really feels like the comic book X-Men 2, in that it's, you know, everybody's kind of smashed and split up, and it's an incredibly overwhelming story because that's the nature of the team. They're seen as outcasts, they're seen as pariahs, and, you know, so they're not frontline like the Avengers, so it really plays into those kind of themes very, very well. And that's another one where you have like great actors leading.
Yeah, I forget his name, but the well-known actor who plays Stryker is
Brian Cox.
Brian Cox. I kept thinking of Bill Paxton. Brian Cox. He's I know.
Bill Paxton would be a good Stryker too.
He's my favorite character in it for sure. And just the storyline about him and his son is just so deep and emotional. Yeah. And it wasn't straight up just action. There was feels. It was just everything I wanted in a comic book film.
Yeah, and that was great. Although I think the series has gotten a little obsessed with Stryker. Stryker was like in like the one graphic novel, and he's been in like five of the movies.
Yeah.
Vince, what do you got for number two?
So my number two is actually pretty easy. I just had to determine where on the list it went. And it's Frank Miller's Sin City, directed by Robert Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. This is another kind of violent, very dark.
Yeah, there's a theme to all that.
There is, yeah. And honestly, like, Spawn is another one of my favorite. Like, I guess you would call him maybe an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. But that kind of superhero, for lack of a better term, is, like, those darker ones are ones that I gravitate towards. But this movie is, it's like Pulp Fiction by way of Robert Rodriguez, just the way the like narratives all kind of unfold. And I remember Frank Miller talking about this. He was like, I just wanted to do a movie with like big guys in like dark trench coats and, you know, kind of cover those tropes of like the noir genre. And then you add in kind of the visual. A lot of it is CG, I will admit. But yeah. I think it kind of adds to the whole
style. It's very stylized,
yeah. Yeah, very much. And not sure how you felt about the sequel. Didn't really care for the sequel that much. But
no.
The first one was definitely one of my favorite comic book movies ever.
Well, I think the sequel suffers from a case of sequelitis, and you know, you waiting too long. I think And I rewatched Sin City recently, and I think it still holds up, both in terms of the effects of work done and how it's made and the performances. But yeah, the sequel, you know, where they made it, I guess it was almost 10 years later.
Yeah, and everyone was talking about it. Is Mickey Rourke going to come back? Is Mickey Rourke going to come back? And then it's like by the time he came back, it was like, well, maybe the script was actually what we should have been working on. But there was an interesting controversy with Sin City, too, I remember, because I think they co-directed it, Frank Miller and Robert Rodriguez. Yeah. And the Directors Guild of America didn't want to give both of them credit for directing one film. I think they also did that with the Coen brothers as well. So they both left the DGA out of protest, which I find very interesting. Yeah. And also kind of a bizarre rule. But that was one of the stories that I remember from Sin City that I still kind of I still kind of think about. But yeah, number two, Sin City for me.
Yeah. And just to note on that, I think Robert Rodriguez overall has sort of gone downhill since then. I think that was that.
Yeah.
He did that, and then he did Planet Terror for the Grindhouse, which I think is actually the better of the
I would agree with that.
And then since then, he's like gone into like doing the Machete movies, which and then the Dame to Kill For, which is a Sin City sequel, which should have been, I think, better. But I wonder how much of it too is Frank Miller's influence, because Frank Miller's kind of gone off the reservation a bit.
Okay. I see. But I don't know much about Frank Miller, actually.
Yeah.
He directed one of his graphic novel films, The Spirit, and it got the worst reviews of all the ones you've been talking
and
about.
And I watched that again recently. And
he directed that. Okay. Yeah.
It is horrid. Anyway.
With that being said, your number two is The Spirit.
That would be hilarious. But no, my number two is actually The Avengers.
Really?
I think it's on the one hand, it's sort of evocative of everything that sort of is going wrong about blockbusters in general, and the comic movies in particular, about like shared universes and multi-movie story arcs and that kind of thing. But I think what impresses me is the level of difficulty it was to get it right. And the fact that it was sort of entrusted to Joss Whedon, who was not a huge well-known filmmaker. He had one movie under his belt before this. He's more known for it being a TV guy, and also more known for being a writer than necessarily a director, although he directed a lot of the better episodes, or the best episodes of Buffy.
Wrote Toy Story.
He co-wrote Toy Story 2 when he was in this like script doctor days. And he did a rewrite of Speed 2. So not Speed 2, but Speed as well, I should say. They're the first Speed movie. It was an incredibly difficult feat to make this sort of a coherent movie and not just make it look like a mashup of the other characters that have came before. It stands on its own. You don't necessarily have to have seen the movies that came before it. You don't necessarily have to see the movies that come after it. It has Whedon's voice from the minute you start hearing people talking. That is, you know, they're doing the Whedon speak, and it fits in the universe. Everybody kind of has their moment. And he actually, I think, improved upon characters who had been introduced before in, you know, sort of a bare bones way. Like, I think he made Fury a better character. He made Black Widow a better character.
The Hulk.
He made the Hulk a better character, absolutely.
Way better character.
Even somebody like Coulson, who was just kind of like, you know, wooden kind of government guy who's in the background of these movies. It actually makes you feel bad in that movie, spoiler alert, when Coulson is killed. I mean,
But Joss Whedon purposely did that
sure.
to lead him on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show.
Yeah, and they brought him back. Mm-hmm. But that there could be a debate about.
So did you enjoy it after the first viewing? In the theater, or did it take time to...
No, I enjoyed it right away. Oh, okay. Funnily enough, I was leaving the theater, and there were two guys in front of me, and one of them says, like, that is the best movie I will ever see. And it's like, oh, that sounds kind of disappointing for you. But I think that's straight-up popcorn entertainment. It's great, and it's insanely rewatchable. You can watch it again and again. And I think when you look at the sequel, Avengers Age of Ultron, it shows you just how remarkable the first one is in terms of getting the alchemy right and balancing all the aspects. And because he did Avengers Age of Ultron 2, and there are problems. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it does have a bit of wear on it. It does feel like it was a bit more pressured to be, you know, have more connectivity and to, you know, to do certain things that a franchise needs to do, and not like this where it can do both at the same time.
Do you still enjoy rewatching it, even though it's pretty much just a like straight up action film?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's one of those movies where you can just put it on and you can. I don't want to say zone out, but you know, it's good popcorn. It's like a comfort movie, I guess. It's comfort food.
It's what Pauline Kael might call good trash.
I don't know. Again, trash. It sounds like
actually,
it's,
maybe that fits Punisher Warzone more than the Avengers.
Maybe. So, Peter, number three.
I picked Dread.
Oh yeah,
number three, nice. Dread 3D.
Wait, did I go the wrong way? We're doing 1 to 3. Okay.
I'm just saying my three favorite. I don't have.
We're not going back. We're not going back and starting the show again.
All right.
Dread. Yes.
I just thought the cast was great. I thought Carl Urban, Lena Headey, Cersei Lannister, especially one of my favorite actors, or at least up-and-coming actors, Domhnall Gleeson.
Oh, yeah.
Who
was
spectacular in it. Just looking at him was fantastic. It was a really visually appealing film. The kind of graphics they used, it looked like I was watching a comic book.
Yeah,
they kept it the same, and it was pretty canon in the sense that it was all in the one building. On sitcoms, I love the canon episodes, so I was a huge fan of that. And all the slow-mo they did, and just everything. The CGI was spectacular, and possibly my favorite part, same reason why I've heard Baby Driver is fantastic, is the music. Mm-hmm. The music in Dread was electronic music. It was perfect music for what the film was.
I don't remember any Simon and Garfunkel in Dread, but no, I'm just kidding. But I know what you mean.
You had to wait for the credits.
Anyway.
But yeah, it's I like Dread a lot too, and I've revisited it a few times. It's great. It's a bottle movie, and I think that was done, you know, budgetary reasons. Mm-hmm. But sometimes less is more, and I think that Dread definitely proves that. Mm-hmm.
I followed the Reddit page and the Facebook page to get a sequel for this darn Dread.
Dread was, for me, is a really good example of like remakes done right.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah,
they
that's
took
right.
a bad movie and they remade it into a good movie, as opposed to what they normally do, which is take old good movies and then turn them into either mediocre or bad or just generally not of the same caliber.
Not necessary, not needed.
I remember walking away from Dread going like, man, why don't they do that more often?
Mm-hmm. So you saw it in theaters?
I did, yeah.
That's good.
It's a fantastic movie. I actually completely agree with your assessment of Dread.
Good.
Totally underrated movie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then what's your number three, Vince?
So my favorite comic book movie of all time is Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World.
Oh, yeah.
Based on the graphic novel by Daniel Klaus. It's not only... and I was not actually familiar with the comic or the graphic novel, the previous art form anyway. And this movie has gotten me through some pretty dark times in my life, I have to say. Mm-hmm. There's something about the characters in this movie. There's something about the sort of defiant, almost like just... almost anti kind of studio nature about it. Mm. Terry Zwigoff is very much like that. I don't know if you remember his first documentary, Crumb, but he's obsessed with those kind of just kind of strange characters.
Mm-hmm.
But Ghost World is one of my favorite movies of all time. That is my number one.
Also has Scarlett Johansson in it.
A very young Scarlett Johansson, absolutely. I think she was like 15 when she did it, and recently came out on Criterion, actually. So
oh, okay, cool.
Let's just pick that up again.
Following along those lines, and this isn't my favorite of all time, but I did want to highlight it because I think it is really great, and it's another example of how you can sort of bend the art form. American Splendor.
Yes.
Which is about Harvey Pekar. It's a very similar world to Crumb in terms of, you know, independent graphic novels.
And just like a curmudgeonly kind of artistic, like,
exactly.
protagonist that, yeah.
And yeah, that's it exactly. And like, there are scenes in this where he's like so thoroughly unlikable, you can't help but root for him. But what's interesting is on a couple of levels. First of all, it shows like sort of the flip side of being in this world and this art form, because yeah, I think a lot of people look at somebody like Stan Lee, who Stanley's like a multi millionaire, but there's a dark side to this where you have somebody like the Schuster family and the Siegel family, who've been in court for decades to get their share of the Superman revenue.
Right.
You know, somebody like Bill Finger recently just, you know, it was only recently he started to be acknowledged as basically a co-creator of Batman. Steve Ditko, I mean, speaking of Spider-Man, Steve Ditko practically lives in obscurity, even though he does get the credit for co-creating Spider-Man. But he doesn't go out to the conventions. He doesn't, you know, he's not taking these victory laps that Stan Lee gets to take every time he cameos in one of these movies. So, you know, looking at the life of Harvey Pekar is very much in that. And there's several scenes where he shows up on, I guess it was when David Letterman was doing Late Night.
Yeah.
Where he's a guest on Late Night, where he's basically being brought on as one of these characters that Letterman would have on, where they're the local weirdo. And so he gets to do some riffing on him.
Get to milk them for some comedic right. material.
Exactly. So, you know, that's a great, there's a great statement in that, but there's also, you know, a great statement in terms of just, you know, the passion of this. He's not the artist, but he's like the writer. He sort of farms out the art to other artists. And so he's writing it all in stick figure form while being like a file clerk at I think it's an insurance company he worked at. And then, the film is also interesting because it's not like a biographical movie. It's obviously about his life based on his graphic novels, but there's also interviews with him in it, and his wife, I can't remember her name off the top of my head. I did write it down. Joyce, his wife Joyce, and also the people in the movie who he worked with and inspired characters in American Splendor. So it just sort of like breaks the contours all over. It's not just a straight up movie. It's not just a straight up adaptation. It's kind of part documentary as well. It's got comedy. It's got drama. At the center of it all is Paul Giamatti. Maybe one of his better performances.
I love Paul Giamatti.
Yeah, and I was going to say he's much better here than he was in Amazing Spider-Man 2, which Peter does not acknowledge.
Yeah. Well, I didn't see that one.
But yeah, it is really great. It's a really great little film. You know, Harvey Pekar, well-known curmudgeon, it's fun to watch little moments of, you know, him actually enjoying life despite the tremendous amount of crap he sees around him. And he uses the word crap quite literally as well as other words, but
and the comedy is very much it's entirely based on your own perspective, I feel. Like,
yeah.
Some people might find it very funny.
Yeah.
People like me, for instance, found the comedy in Ghost World to be like very real. Like, I was like, yeah, that's pretty much what the world is like. So there's a different, depending on what you're bringing to the film, I think you'll find it either funny or just tonally kind of your own thing.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you take in what you bring with you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap up our comic book discussion. Well, at least a more general comic book discussion, because we do have the movie Spider-Man Homecoming coming up after the break. And that break will be the song Spiderhead by Cage the Elephant from their 2013 album Melophobia, which means to have a fear of music. So I hope you are not going to be triggered if you do have melophobia by this tune. And we'll be right back with our review of Spider-Man Homecoming. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. You may take my heart, take it all.
They stopped.
Huh. Marilyn?
What's there?
I mean, I don't know. Evil lair.
You have a lair?
Dude, a gang with alien guns run by a guy with wings? Yeah, they have a lair.
Badass.
But how are you gonna get there if it's like 300 miles away?
It's not too far from DC.
Hey, Spita!
Gosh, hey, Peter?
Yeah, I was hoping maybe I could rejoin the team.
No, no way. You can't just quit on us, stroll up, and be welcomed back by everyone.
Hey, welcome back, Peter. Flash, you're back to first alternate.
What?
He's taking your place.
Excuse me, can we go already? Because I was hoping to get in some light protesting in front of one of the embassies before dinner, so.
Protesting is patriotic. Let's get on the bus.
And that was a scene from Spider-Man Homecoming. It is the new Spider-Man film currently in theaters, the latest in the Marvel superhero adventure film series that stars Tom Holland, Marissa Tomei, Michael Keaton, Jon Favreau, Zendaya, Jacob Ballotin, and Robert Downey Jr. And I think one of the reasons I chose that scene is pretty indicative, where I think it really balances well the whole Spider-Man adventure and the high school malaise, I guess we want to call it, right? You know, he's worrying about field trips and being part of extracurriculars and, you know, hanging out with friends and having a crush on a girl. And it's a really incredible balance. It sort of reminded me, I don't know if we brought up Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
No,
we're talking about Joss Whedon, but it did sort of remind me of that, where it's about how do you balance being the superhero and then being the regular old high school student, and how the one is definitely more exciting than the other.
I thought this did a better job of that than the other Spider-Mans too. I thought there was a lot more high school footage, which I liked, and he was actually played by someone of that age, not like a 30-year-old like Tobey Maguire. So he actually was a high school student. I just really enjoyed that. I liked the social parts of movies. I like the realistic parts, so I'm glad that this superhero movie had a lot of that, just him and his friends and the girls he has crushes on in the high school, and the teachers, both of the teachers, the debate leader and the coach teacher, two of my favorite characters. Hilarious. Hannibal Buress and Martin Starr, giving both of you amazing comedians a shout out.
Yeah, I love that scene with Hannibal Buress. And we were talking about this during the break. You see these videos throughout, of these educational videos of Captain America. And I love this, the one in the gym of the Captain America fitness challenge. And Hannibal Buress, as a coach, says, "All right, you heard Captain America," even though I think he's a war criminal now, referring to what happened in Civil War. But yeah. that's a great scene where they kind of balance the fact that it feels very lived in. That's another thing I really appreciated. It feels very lived in the Marvel universe, where mm-hmm. There's a scene where Flash makes a joke, about how, oh yeah, I have a hot day with Black Widow, which mm-hmm. is something people would joke about if the Marvel universe was real. And the scene where there's an action scene in Washington, where Spider-Man's running down the mall in his Spider-Man costume, and everyone kind of looks, but not everyone's terribly, hey, what's this guy in a Spider-Man outfit? Because that would kind of be a regular occurrence. You would see Iron Man fly overhead, or the Avengers plane, flying through this over the city and things like that. Anyway, what did you think, Vince?
Well, first of all, I would like to just point out the irony of Michael Keaton playing a villain in a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Not only doing that, but playing a guy in a bird suit.
A bird-themed villain. Yep.
Like, he must have just gotten
two
quips.
Superheroes and a villain.
Yeah. On the set of that movie, I would have just been cracking jokes the whole time. But I should preface by saying, I'm not... a diehard enthusiast, I guess, of these particular movies. I didn't really get some of the inside kind of nudges, I guess.
Right.
Iron Man, Tony Stark being in the movie. He actually plays a pretty significant role in the movie.
Yeah.
And it was all just kind of out of left field for me. But with that being said, it was a very enjoyable experience nonetheless. I've always kind of had this image of Spider-Man as this turmoiled high school student, and I thought this one captured that tone better than any other Spider-Man movie. And people keep saying, I see some people's reactions when one of these films comes out and they're like, oh, another Spider-Man movie. But there really is something different about this one.
Absolutely.
It doesn't go through the very kind of tired formula of him becoming this and that and the other thing. I just really liked how they had the homecoming, you know, like they never they're always reminding you that he's a high school student, and it's like homecoming is kind of looming in the distance, and everything's building up to the homecoming dance. And it was just really fun. And but with that being said, it's like I'm tired of saying this movie is fun and not having a lot more to say about it. You know what I mean? I'm not sure, I guess, what I'm ultimately trying to get at, but it just felt formulaic, I guess, in some ways. With that being said,
I actually got more in depth with the characters in this one than any other Avengers films because of the focus of the high school and just the regular humans, as opposed to the focus of like five characters in the Avengers or whatever that are all superheroes, you know?
Yeah, because even in the Captain America, you know, movies, you know, his best friend is the Falcon, and his sidekick is Black Widow.
Exactly.
So he's always kind of hanging out with people sort of in the business. And then you get Thor, and then, you know, he's on Asgard, where basically everyone's a superhero. It's kind of a refreshing direction. It's because everybody around him is sort of normal, which is kind of why he gravitates towards Tony Stark. And that's another, to address your thing about how it's different from the other Spider-Man movies,
right,
is that this movie, he's actually wanting to, I have found in the previous Spider-Man movies, a large segment of the plot comes down to him not wanting to be Spider-Man, or how it's a burden to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And in this movie, he's anxious to be Spider-Man. He wants to be Spider-Man. There's a scene, the scene near the beginning, where it shows him going to each class, and he's constantly looking at the clock because he knows at 3 o'clock that's when he can go out and be Spider-Man. And there was an eager to this I appreciate, because, you know, just in the genre in general, it's hard to find movies where people are excited to be a superhero. It's always like a burden. It's always a
reluctant kind of
a reluctant
thing.
Yeah,
yeah. And I liked your comparison with the John Hughes comparison. Actually, I found myself laughing like much more than I thought I was.
Laughs like an adventure, like, oh, like chuckles. Like, I was laughing my butt off watching this.
I almost want to say, like, if you're not into the superhero stuff, you will, like, you can watch it just as a comedy almost, because it really is that.
There was a lot of little tiny comic book lovers, little hints that only they would see. Mm-hmm. Martin Starr's character was actually already in The Incredible Hulk, the one with Edward Norton.
Yeah.
He makes a brief appearance. And Spider-Man's best friend in the comic books ends up as Hobgoblin. So they're all kind of regular real people in this one. But I think in the next one, things are going to change.
Yeah, it's I do find it that's probably where they'll pick up on it as they go along. Because there are a lot of little nods like that. And but yeah, I do have to praise again the thing in the all base in the high school. I also like that the high school cast is how it just kind of quietly reinforces the diversity. You know, and the Flash Thompson, who is this big burly bully, classic kind of Jacques character from the comic books, in this movie is played by Tony Revolori, who you may know from Grand Budapest Hotel. He was the lobby boy.
He's in so many commercials too, TV commercials.
But I mean, he's like this skinny nerd figure, and so it's interesting to watch, you know, them take that character, who is like the typical archetypal American jock character, and turn into a skinny Indian boy who's also Peter's equal intellectually, and is less of a bully in the classic sense, and more of a kind of a rival.
Bullies are more like that nowadays. It's less jocks and more kind of comedic people who take their comedy out on others, right? Use their comedy for others.
You're closer to high school than I am, but so you would have that grander insight. I liked Zendaya a lot. I liked her character.
Her music?
I can't say for certain I've heard a Zendaya song, but I did like, I did like how she's kind of like on the periphery, and she's, you know, she's kind of always there. And there's a scene where she's in detention, and Peter sneaks out of detention to go through Spider-Man stuff. And then the teacher says, like, "What are you even doing here?" She's like, "I like to sketch the sadness. And then here's a picture of you." Yeah. It's, that's great.
And then when she gives her nickname, MJ, yes. Right?
Well, that's kind of a spoiler there.
Oh, I thought we were allowed to talk about spoilers. My apologies.
That's all right. But I think that's been kind of out there for a while. I mean, she's not playing the MJ, but it was a cute little nod, I think. It, you know, kind of reminds me, speaking of spoilers, the end of Dark Knight Rises, when you find out John Blake's real first name is Robin.
Yeah. It also feels very contemporary too. Like, he's got some like neat kind of almost Bond-esque like gadgets on his suit now, and you can just feel that it's moved into like the modern age, you know what I mean? There's just these digital enhancements, I guess, that he's kind of got. I don't know if those have been around for a while, but I'm unfamiliar with seeing Spider-Man with anything other than the ability to like shoot webs.
So. Those were all through Stark's company. He got all those.
Stark designed his suit.
That makes sense. Yeah.
It combines like various things that Spider-Man's had over the years. In the comics, I almost wish he didn't have too much like high tech. I did like the interplay because he has his own little AI in a suit that he calls Karen.
But the spider like shaped drones were maybe a little excessive.
Yeah, that was a little excessive. And although I did like I did like some of the web stuff, like having the web grenade and that kind of thing. I love the scene where he's kind of stuck in this sort of lockdown facility, and he's doing all this web stuff, and you see him like just kind of fool around, and then you see him and he goes, "How long have I been trapped in here?" And his AI says 37 minutes. He's like, "What?" Little stuff like that.
And what happens after, like shortly after that, I won't give too much away, but he gets stuck in a precarious kind of situation. That was actually kind of like an intense, almost moving moment for me to see Spider-Man like that.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that film to get that intense.
Yeah.
And I thought Tom Holland played that moment very, very well, actually.
I think that's something this movie does really, really well is it's a very classic Spider-Man thing, which is to show that Spider-Man... first of all, when Spider-Man wins, he kind of loses, and you see that at the end of the film, and I won't spoil how that goes, but also the fact that he's learning, he's not awesome at this yet, he's trying to do the heroic thing, but he's inexperienced, and sometimes he has to have his butt covered by Tony Stark. And one thing that I will say about Robert Downey Jr. is that I didn't think he was in this as much as he was going to be, as the trailer sold it. I think all the Tony Stark scenes are kind of have been played in the trailers already. Mm-hmm. But that I did appreciate that. And I wish there was more of the little neighborhood Spider-Man moments that you see at the beginning where he like stops the bike thief. Because that's one of my favorite moments in the last Spider-Man movie, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which I know you did not see. But there's a scene in it where where this kid's being bullied, and he's carrying his science for a project home, and he's being like chased by three older kids, and Spider-Man sort of steps in and scares the bullies away.
And
Spider-Man walks him home talking about his science project. I love that stuff. This is like that, and Spider-Man's the hero to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's the aspect of it I really like that they played up, is the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man angle. I wish there had been more of it, because once the Vulture kind of appears, takes it into the major sort of action plot driven piece of the film.
I thought Michael Keaton as the Vulture though was probably my favorite part of the film. I thought he was spectacular.
Yeah. And I like how he there's still very down to earth motives for him. You know, he's this, you know, blue collar worker guy who's been, you know, he's screwed out of a contract because, you know, and there's a great line in it where this new government department, I guess, like, it sounds kind of like a public-private kind of corporation called Damage Control, which cleans up superhero messes from superhero battles. And he talks about how, you know, Tony Stark creates a mess and then gets the profit off cleaning it up. And there's something about that that sounded very, you know, Dick Cheney.
Relevant, yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very relevant.
It was...
So, forgive me, was Vulture part of the Spider-Man lore
beforehand? Yeah, he's a classic Spider-Man villain.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, but he's like in the comic book, he's like Mr. Magoo in a skin tight green suit with, you know, wings.
It's not a major villain. He's not like the Green Goblin or anything like that.
But the movie does a good job of sort of elevating him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with Michael Keaton, you're not only getting a great actor, but you're getting this really great motive. And you're getting something that plays off what's been established before in the movies, because if you had all this alien junk and advanced technology lying around, somebody would probably try and take advantage of it. And his motives are very, they're not honest, but the reasons he says he's doing is, you know, so he can, you know, help his family and to pay the bills. And
it's not mindless destruction for no reason.
Yeah, he's not out to take over the world. He's
right.
He's just basically, you know, he says the line, basically, the world is changing, so we have to change with it. We have to take what's ours. And there's a great moment where he's talking to Spider-Man and he's like saying, well, you know, what are you fighting for? People who are like up in Stark Tower for, you know, fighting for basically it's the one percenter counter arguments. Like, what are you fighting for them for? You know, you're one of us. You're down here on the streets trying to help people. You know, why are you worried about protecting them? Yeah. And it's one of these things where after you immediately see a movie and you're really kind of jazzed about it and you're like, yes, Michael Keaton was one of the best villains ever, and
he's one of the best superheroes ever.
Well, that too. But we had about 30 years, the distance between that. But I do wonder, going forward, if he holds up. Because I did find him very compelling as a villain. Mm-hmm. And I did find it very refreshing that this had nothing to do about taking over the world or collecting Infinity Stones and that kind of thing.
Me too. I liked how separated it was from the other MCU films, other than some brief Tony Stark and some Gwyneth Paltrow at the end. One thing I wanted to add that I forgot to mention, there is a reason it was so comedic. The main writer was Jonathan Goldstein.
Right.
Was one of the main writers for Community.
Right.
And might John also explain Daly, who was Sam, the main character in Freaks and Geeks.
That's right.
Because Donald Glover is in the film as well.
Right. I totally forgot about that.
So it makes sense he was affiliated with somebody that was working for...
He asked them to get in.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because there was a whole... Everyone, his fans were crazy and wanted him to be, like, the Spider-Man. Because
he's a big Spider-Man fan in real life.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is why there's, like, one of those season premieres of Community. It shows... I can't remember his character's name. Troy. Mm. Troy wakes up and he's wearing Spider-Man pajamas and it's like the Spider-Man suit. which I remember a friend of mine having when I was a kid. And he was Spider-Man obsessed too. But so that was fun. And I do love that scene where he's interrogating Donald Glover.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
it's, you know, he's trying to be Batman. But
his character's in the comics, so we're going to see him again.
Oh, that's, yeah. I did remember reading that, yeah. I loved having Jon Favreau in it as kind of like the
in
his
anything,
begrudging man. Link to Tony Stark as Spider-Man's begrudging link and calling him all the time. The one thing I was kind of disappointed about was, sadly, was having Marissa Tomei as Aunt May, because I thought like the idea of sort of making Aunt May a bit younger might have played into what they wanted to do with the character a bit more, but... It seemed to be there so that everyone could make jokes about Aunt May being hot.
I hated that.
Yeah, and the one great scene I think with her is when he goes to her, when he's asked his crush to the homecoming dance, and he has like, and he goes to Aunt May. He's like, okay, now what do I do? And it shows them like practicing dance moves and her picking out like a suit for him and showing him how to tie a tie. I love that scene a lot. Even though it's like basically a montage, but I wish they had done more with Aunt May and with Marissa Tomei.
Yeah. It wasn't the Aunt May from Spider-Man, the original Sam Raimi one. She was just perfect. She was everything I want in an elderly aunt.
So what was she in the like comics? Like in the earlier ones, was she like an elderly?
Yeah. Aunt May is classically portrayed as more.
She's never been under 65.
Right. Okay.
I doubt Aunt May's ever been under 75. But, I understand the logical reason, because you wouldn't have somebody with a 85-year-old sister and having a 12-year-old boy, but I just thought there would be more to it, because why would you cast Marissa Tomei if she's just going to be there to, like, you be careful out there, you stay away from those superhero battles, because you could have just gotten somebody, anybody like that, and not just Marissa Tomei, who brings so much energy. And I do find it interesting, like, there's a couple of scenes where they have her in, like, the big grandma glasses, and I wonder if that was kind of intentional, but anyway. Because, in Hollywood, if you wear glasses, you're not attractive. You're only attractive when you take off the glasses.
That's true.
I think, Vince, you probably the least enthusiastic of this, but you recognize that it is a fun movie, a fun superhero movie.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it's hard not to be familiar with the kind of, with Spider-Man as a character now.
Yeah.
So with that being said, it is most definitely a fun, extremely entertaining movie.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I'll add is, I think most people, or a lot of people, are aware that you have these end credits sequences now after the end, not end credits, the show, but post-credit sequences. And I want to put this out there. I think that the post-credit scene for Spider-Man Homecoming is probably the best one, because it has no bearing whatsoever. Like, it doesn't tease a future film, or it doesn't have like a cameo from, like, Doctor Strange or Black Panther or something like that. It's just, it's kind of meta, but it's hilarious, and I think it's the perfect. When I was in my screening, the people who stuck around, a couple of them were pissed about it, but I loved it.
So is that consistent among the Marvel, like, those post-credit?
Yeah.
Sequences? Oh, okay.
Yeah, they
even do. Ones that aren't owned by, like, MCU, like Deadpool did that too.
Well, in Deadpool, that was a very meta one with the Ferris Bueller reference.
Yeah.
But, that's another thing with this is they did the very pointed Ferris Bueller reference, and then they show a clip from the people watching a clip from Ferris Bueller as it was going on. It's just like, I think we all know where this is from. I don't think you need to bash us over the head with it. But anyway, I think we're getting into nitpicking territory now. Anyway, we'll wrap it up there. And with just by saying, if you want to go see a superhero movie this week, make it Spider-Man Homecoming. This is the end for this week's edition of End Credits, and we hope you liked it. And if you did like it, it will be available again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. And you can also connect with us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on the Twitter feeds. Peter, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Mr. Tarak, that is my Twitter. And that's it.
Yeah, you're the one Twitter man. Or the one Twitter.
I love that Twitter.
Yeah.
Hashtag.
How can we get in touch with you?
You can look me up on Facebook, Vincent Masson, or you can shoot me an email, v-masson@hotmail.com.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for coming in and talking Spider-Man today.
Of course.
I write about movies, TV shows, and other nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com. And I will be back here later today at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph. And that is with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And be back here next week at 10 a.m. on Thursdays for more End Credits. And we will see you then.